these weekly visits with the famous and the fascinating, this series of broadcasts comes to an end. The informal parties I've held round the seasons at Sardi's East, the Park Sheraton, Las Vegas, Hollywood, and elsewhere have usually been light-hearted gatherings. So rather than have one last session which might turn into a wake, I've browsed among the recordings of past shows and lifted some passages I'd like to hear again. This is not a definitive anthology. Over 1,000 persons have talked with me at these gatherings, but here are some people saying some things I've remembered. Stuart Metz, may we have their names, please?
Indeed you may, Mitch. And quite a memorable finale you've arranged for your prize-winning series of broadcasts on CBS Radio. And after 6 years together, I'm very sorry, but this is the last time I'll be saying, this is the Mitch Miller Show. But I'm delighted to announce the voices we'll be hearing tonight in your recollections of the informal get-togethers you've hosted. Listen to their names. Abe Burrows, Richard Burton, Gary Cooper, Eddie Foy Jr., Janet Gaynor, Lillian Gish, Oscar Hammerstein II. Moss Hart, Peter Lind Hayes, Alexander King, Charles Lawton, Alan J. Lerner and Fritz Lowe, Joe E. Lewis, Harold Lloyd, Mary Pickford, Carlos P. Romulo, Billy Rose, Carl Sandburg, Smith and Dale, James Thurber, and Peter Ustinov. Mitch begins his stroll down memory lane after these few words from Standard Brands.
Coffee nectar, that's what's been missing. Missing in your instant coffee, new instant taste, and Sanborn has pure coffee nectar.
Enjoy the richness of a pure coffee nectar in new Instant Chasen Sanborn. The rich new instant from Chasen Sanborn. Fine coffee for nearly 100 years.
Now, here is radio's most listened to host to the famous and the fascinating, the Beard himself, Mitch Miller.
Thank you, Stu. Let's begin these browsings with some observations by Billy Rose. The colorful little showman has been a close friend of financier Bernard Baruch since he took shorthand for the older man during the First World War. I urged him to talk about Baruch.
He may well have been the best-looking man in North America. You know, Bernie is 6'4", pink skin, white hair, and all that money, all that head, and all the good clothes and all that Carolina charm. It was a wonderful combination, plus the fact that he was an authentic genius.
Well, has he given you any recent fatherly advice you could pass along to any of us?
Well, I play the market a little, and Bernie not long ago said, never gamble the necessary to win the superfluous. He's going to stop me. That sounds like the giggle of a loser. Not long ago, I asked him about a certain fellow. I said, can I trust him? He said, well, he's a nice fellow, but I wouldn't fall asleep with my finger in his mouth.
Beautiful.
Bernie, or Mr. Brook, will be 91 years of age this August, and he recently said to me, he says, you know, I'm old enough to come in duty-free.
Rose on Baruch. Remember, as we go on, that most of these broadcasts were done live, and all of them were spontaneous. We never discussed in advance with our guests the questions they'd be asked. Next, the Philippine ambassador to the United States, Carlos P. Romulo. Mr. Romulo tells why, when he first came to the United States as a struggling young student, a rumor went around that he was from an incredibly wealthy family.
Well, I took the train from Vancouver to New York. And I took the Canadian Pacific Railway. So the first time I went to the dining room, I saw that the plates and the silverware carried the initials. CPR, my own initials. So the waiter said to me, well, you can get this as souvenir, which I did. Towels, napkins, silverware. So when I arrived here in New York, and my landlady saw all this, custom made, she thought I was really somebody. I had my initials on all these things. And I hope the statute of limitations of the Canadian government...
The late Gary Cooper was not as silent as legend had it. His enormous personal magnetism Star quality, they call it, comes through in the following. Coop was asked about his youthful career as a cartoonist and how it was that he left Montana as a boy to live in England for a time.
I wanted to be a cartoonist. I wanted to study art and become an artist. That's true. I happened to be home from school when I was a young brat during a political campaign at home, and my father said, why don't you do a couple of cartoons for the election, for the campaign? So, and we discussed some political situations and personalities involved, and I did two or three, and they printed two or three, fortunately. But that's the limit of my career as a cartoonist. My father came from England when he was a young boy, and he started out, he's working, before he started studying law, he was working on the railroad. He was an engine wiper, I remember. And then he met my mother, who also came from England. And they were married, and I was born in Montana, which is a great place to be born in anyway. And so we went back to see my grandparents. My maternal grandmother and my paternal grandfather were alive, so we went back there, and my brother and I stayed in school there for 3 years. That's the reason I went to school in England, and of course we were tickled to get back to Montana.
Gary, did you pick up an English accent over there and come back and have the kids hoot at you a little bit?
They hooted at me. I picked it up quite unconsciously, and I forgot it as rapidly as I could. It was very embarrassing.
Gary Cooper. We have many cowboy stars, but he will never be replaced. When Peter Ustinov first came to this country a few years ago, he had a reputation in England as a playwright, actor, and wit, but was almost unknown here. I met Peter at a party where he broke me up with his impression of an airplane ride he had recently taken. And when he came on the show a short time later, I reminded him of that plane trip.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, there are many aspects of American technical accomplishment which we take our hat off to. But there are some aspects of it which we're not quite used to yet for more primitive parts of the world. And one is this intercommunication system in airplanes. In Europe, we get into an airplane and we presumably arrive at the other side. There's nothing more to it. The door is shut and the thing takes off. But once I had to leave from Rome to Paris, which was a very short run, and the European airline on which I'd booked was on strike. It usually is on strike. And I had to get a large American airplane, which was going on to New York. And were the only other passengers were the whole of the Egyptian delegation to Lake Success, who were going to present their case. I don't remember which case it was. They were going to present one, and a great many of them, and it was Christmas. And they had a Christmas tree in the aeroplane and holly. And this didn't mean very much. The Egyptians came in, they were all talking, and they had a very young assistant to the pilot, very nervous. I think it must have been his first trip. And he went into a long spiel, which I'd never heard before at that time, saying, I want to take this opportunity of welcoming you aboard and wishing you a very happy Christmas on behalf of the associate corporations of this airline. In case we land on water, and that idea had never struck me on the He said, I want you to lean forward and just, will you please reach for the, please, will you all follow me, that gentleman? And they had great trouble because one of the Egyptians blew up his device and they couldn't depress it again. And eventually we left, and I started trying to fall asleep, and I had no idea that this little grill above my head was the voice of the pilot. And suddenly, just as I was getting to sleep, this thing went...
Well, folks, we're about 500 minutes late, and we're in a weather direction.
And this thing happened two or three times, and suddenly we flew into an enormous electric storm, and we fell into an air pocket. I thought it was never the Christmas tree fell down, the holly fell down, and the Egyptians started struggling. And I could see when we landed in Paris who'd been sitting on which side of the aeroplane, by which side the cuts were on the face. They'd been struggling with his holly, which... And just as we reached the bottom of the air pocket, and I thought this is the end, the thing righted itself, and through the intercom came...
Peter Ustinov. More for past shows of this series after a very few words from a sponsor.
Who did it? How did they do it? What in the world did they do?
Now, the menthol cigarette has tobacco flavor a man can get hold of. Alpine always tastes rich, never smokes rough. Alpine filter cigarettes.
Nice. Joe E. Lewis is a tremendous nightclub comedian who is always on the move. I finally cornered him in Las Vegas, where he gambles almost as hard as he performs. I asked Joe about his employer in the Vegas club he was working.
Yesterday was raining, you know, and he sent his car for me. But I got out of the way just in time, you know.
Ah, that's what he did.
And he's a wonderful guy to work around. And he gave me the most beautiful present on my last engagement I ever had in my life.
What was that,
sir? Well, if money ever comes back, I have a beautiful wallet.
I'll never forget the night when you came in late. They were waiting for you. You flew in especially to MC the Ed Sullivan testimonial.
Yes, right.
Yes, which turns out to be a benefit for a charity. I've never known anyone to be as brilliant as you were that night. You can recall some of the things that you said about Ed Sullivan that night.
Well, I said Sullivan had a great personality. He's the only guy I can light up a room leaving it. I forget. But I remember this one line, Mr. Who's the boss of CBS?
Bill Paley.
Who I know, and I know his wife, Mrs. Paley. Now, he was there, and it was late. Oh, everybody in black tie. And Ed was making a speech. And I says to Bill Paley, I says, I just got a call from your missus. He said, what was it? I says, she says, won't you come home, Bill Paley?
Playwright Moss Hart came on the show shortly after becoming a hit in a new field. He wrote a best-selling book. I asked him, after the years of tension at theater opening nights, was there also excitement in publication day of a book?
Yes, but mild compared to the theater. I remember once, I don't remember what play it was, but I had just moved into a new apartment, and I was very proud of that. It had just been newly decorated, and I was very proud of the bedspread in the bedroom, and I was having an opening night party at the apartment afterwards, and as I was dressing to go to the theater, this was before the war, and I was wearing white tie, I decided to remove the bedspread, so when they threw their coats on the bed, it was a sort of a velvet bedspread. And I remember taking off the bedspread and then quietly taking off the white tie and tails from my pants and coat and everything. And as though I was getting ready for bed, I was so nervous. Just removing made me feel I was going to bed and I had to get dressed all over again.
That was Moss Hart. On another occasion, Moss, who directed My Fair Lady, came around with its composers, Alan J. Lerner and Fritz Lowe. You'll hear Alan on the vocal and Fritz at the piano. The song you have probably never heard.
One of my favorite songs is not in My Fair Lady. It was called Come to the Ball. I think you have to, in some way, Alan, tell how it was used.
Oh, yes.
We'll get to the piano, Fritz, so you're ready on cue. Okay, old boy, yeah. When Alan gives you the cue?
Actually, in the play, it was supposed to come after Ascot, when Eliza had made a fool of herself, and she did not want to go on with her lessons. And although the song on the surface seems like a serious song, it wasn't. It was intended to be done by Higgins Harrison, as he, in a sense, conned her into going on by promising her all sorts of wonderful things that would happen at the ball, but I don't remember all the lyrics, and it went on for chorus after chorus, which was one of the reasons
it
went out.
For me, your friend.
Oh, come to the ball, oh, come to the ball. It wouldn't be fair to the men who'll be there to deny them all the dreams you'll supply them. There even may be a dashing marquee who feature by feature will swear you're the creature he always prayed for, single, stayed for. If you aren't there, his complete despair will be painful to see. So come to the ball, come to the ball. Come to the ball, come to the ball. With
me.
I don't remember that.
That, friends, is the way you hear Alan Lerner and Fritz Lowe demonstrate their songs.
That's a charming song.
Sure.
And I think it ought to go in My Fair Lady, by the way.
Alan J. Lerner and Fritz Lowe performed a song that didn't quite make the score of their show, My Fair Lady. A question I sometimes ask actors down through the years was this. When you've played the same part in a play month after month and then year after year, how do you keep your enthusiasm? How do you keep from letting down? Here is the answer of a truly fine actor, Charles Laughton.
Let me tell you a small story. Once upon a time, I was very sick in hospital. And it was a very painful operation. And I was hobbling up and down the corridors. And a man came up to me and said, "Will you go in and see Mama?" So I went in to see Mama. And she was in bed, and she had a rubber tube stuck up her nose with tape. She had needles in her arm. And apparently Mama had not recognized anybody in her family for several weeks. And they'd asked me in to see if she could recognize me. And I said, "Hello, Mama, this is Charles Laughton talking to you." And the hand came out and she clutched my hand. She knew me. And from that moment on, I have never let down. Because there's always somebody in front that means something to you that way. Because they come to see you. They have not only spent their money, but spent their time to come and see you. And I'm just telling you that very simple story.
That was Charles Laughton. After the station break, I'll be back with some more excerpts from broadcasts down through the years. The late Oscar Hammerstein singing a parody lyric. James Thurber talking about his drawing and lots more. Right now, though, I see Stuart Metz standing by with some network business. Stu?
Thank you, Mitch. Right here, this message from General Motors Guardian Maintenance.
Now, here's Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. Brought to you by your Chevrolet, Car and Truck, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Buick, Cadillac, and GMC truck dealers.
Bergen, how about going fishing?
No, Charlie. Today our car gets its Guardian Maintenance summer servicing.
Ah, it can wait.
No, there's a right way and the wrong way to do things, just like the three little pigs. Remember, the first two little pigs built their houses out of straw and sticks, and the wolf says, "I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow."
Yeah, I think I'll blow, too.
And blow your house in. And he did, and ate both little pigs. But the third little pig was protected because he planned ahead, just like we protect our car by giving it Guardian Maintenance summer services.
Like what?
Like a complete lubrication, a front-end adjustment, tire rotation and brake servicing. It's the best kind of care for the best kind of cars and trucks.
Bergen, what happened to the wolf?
Well, he fell down the chimney in a kettle of boiling water. Do you get the moral?
Yeah, wolfing around will get you in hot water.
His final broadcast of this six-year series after a brief pause for station identification. This is the CBS Radio Network.
WANE Radio, the Pleasant Sound, your sing-along station in Fort Wayne. Now is the time to make sure your youngsters go to a YMCA summer camp. At the Y camp, they'll have the kind of vacation they want and like. One that'll help them develop in mind, body, and spirit to meet the challenge of youth. It won't be all swimming and hiking, nature study, and making new friends. They'll acquire the confidence that comes with learning new skills. A feeling of kinship with nature. And a brother's sympathy and understanding for other people. These are the things that give a YMCA camp its full meaning. You can help your youngsters reach for values that will last a lifetime. Send them to the Y Camp for a wonderful summer of fun and growth. Call the YMCA at Anthony 3144 now and make sure they have a place at camp this coming summer. Wonderful Wayne Radio time, exactly 7:30.
Again from New York with his recollections of interviews with Alexander King, James Thurber, Oscar Hammerstein II, Lillian Gish, Harold Lloyd, Janet Gaynor, Mary Pickford, Eddie Foy Jr., Abe Burrows, Carl Sandburg, Smith and Dale, Richard Burton, and Peter Lind Hayes. Here is your host, Mitch Miller.
Thanks again, Stu. Peter Lind Hayes is an amazingly versatile comedian and a favorite of mine. Here he is after being prompted to tell a story about a man he very much admired, the late, great, stuttering comedian Joe Frisco.
The Maskers Club gave him a sort of a farewell dinner, and whether he realized it or not, that's exactly what it was. He died just about 6 days after he made this particular crack. He was wheeled in a wheelchair, and they pulled him up to a microphone. He says, "You guys are probably wondering how it feels to be this sick." He says, "The whole thing started when the doctor came over the Plaza Hotel. He came up to my room. He yanked me up in bed. He hit me in the small of the back, and he says, cough. And I said, I don't want to cough, doctor. And he belted me again, and he says, I said, cough. And I said, I got a pain in my throat. I don't feel like coughing. And then he doubled up his fist, and he really belted me in the back. And he says, cough. And I coughed, and he says, how long you had this cough?
That appreciative cackle at the end of Peter Lind Hayes' story came from Buddy Hackett. If you were at all a listener to these shows, you know that three or four assorted guests join me each week. Sometimes this made for entertainment from surprise sources. The time, for instance, when I talked to Eddie Foy Jr. about his father's vaudeville act, The Seven Little Foys, and playwright-comedian Abe Burrows was on hand. I asked Foy when he first went on the stage.
I really don't remember when I first started. It was back in 1911 when my father said, "We all better go to work around here. He had seven kids to feed." So we all stopped, but I really don't remember show business at all. I was only about six when I started.
Well, Eddie Burrows, what were you doing at that age? Anything to
I was
case?
Watching Eddie Foy. He goes to church on Sunday, and he passes round the contribution box. And in an office on Monday, he's as shrewd and as sly as a fox. On Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, he robs everybody that he can. But he goes to church on Sunday, so they say that he's an honest man.
There's nothing silly about that. That's
my real name was Abe Foy.
Abe Burrows and Eddie Foy Jr. remembering the Foy family act. And Abe remembered better. The late Oscar Hammerstein II was the great lyricist of our theater. Shortly before he died, he came down to one of our gatherings to pay tribute to a composer with whom he had worked many years before, Jerome Kern. In this story, you get the essence of Hammerstein as a lyric writer, his simplicity, his narrative strength, his apt choice of words. He is about to tell how he and Kern, Jerry in this story, were worried about whether Florence Ziegfeld had enough money to go on with a show Kern and Hammerstein were working on.
I was in Jerry's house in Bronxville, and we hadn't heard from Ziegfeld in some time, although he had been hurrying us up to finish Showboat. Since then, he had opened Rio Rita in Boston, and we hadn't heard from him at all. And I said, "Why do you suppose Ziegfeld isn't anxious anymore to hurry us up on Showboat?" And Jerry said, "I don't think he's got the money to put it on." I said, "Well, how do we find out whether or not he has?" And he said, "We go over and ask him." And so 5 minutes later, we were in Jerry's car driving over toward Hastings on the Hudson from Bronxville. Well, we got there, and it was a surprise visit. Ziegfeld didn't know we were coming. We arrived and ushered into a beautiful French drawing room and kept waiting for about 5 minutes. We had been ushered there by a butler who looked like a bank president. And then... then a girl in a real Ziegfeld costume came down, and black with beautiful lace apron and beautiful lace cap, and she said Mr. Ziegfeld would see us presently. And then a second man came down. He looked like a vice president of the bank. And he asked us to follow him, and he led us up the stairs to the east wing, Ziegfeld's suite, and we came into a beautiful big bedroom with a great big four-poster bed And through the door, they could see the bathroom, which is almost as big as the bedroom. And in the bathroom, Ziegfeld was being shaved by King Leopold of Belgium. I mean, he had a long white beard like King Leopold. As Ziegfeld shaving over, he came out to see us in a beautiful brocaded dressing gown, and we had come over to ask him if he was a pauper, you must have. He immediately started to tell us about the grossest Rio Rita was earning in Boston, and what a wonderful show it was, and it all sounded very rich. He also said he had just recently sent down to Florida for some tanks of terrapin, which he was having sent up. He asked us if we would stay for a pickup lunch, and we said we would. And he dined with Ziegfeld and his daughter and her governess, and just Jerry and me. Billy was upstairs with a headache and didn't come down. And there were three men in attendance all the time. We had a beautiful lunch with wine and champagne. And I suppose it was potluck when the Ziegfeld home, but we felt it pretty good. Well, at any rate, Jerry was a man with a great deal of nerve, a great deal of brass. Nothing fazed him. But on that particular day, he never got around to asking Ziegfeld if he had any money.
Having warmed to his subject, Oscar Hammerstein went on to tell how he played a trick on Jerome Kern with a set of lyrics.
Jerry hated any reference to the word Cupid. He thought that was a pretty coy word, and it had been in a good many songs of the period, and it just made his blood boil to hear Cupid. And so when I was setting words to the melody, which later became Why Do I Love You, we were in Washington doing a new song for Showboat. I had his melody, and I wrote a whole refrain called Cupid Knows the Way. And but I didn't send it down to him till I was armed with the other song, with the one I really intended to have him use. And then I sent both songs down to him by my secretary, and she gave him the first one first. Cupid Knows the Way, and he put it on his piano, always very eager about hearing a new lyric. And he started to play his melody to this, and of course, his chin sagged, and he wound up banging his fist on the piano in a rage, and then beginning to believe that I couldn't possibly have written this and meant it. And then when at the right time, she gave him Why Do I Love You.
Oscar,
he got even with me, by the way. He took my typewritten copy, framed it, and my name was under it, too. So he framed it and left it on his mantle all the rest of his life so that people would come up and think I seriously meant that.
Can you give us some of the other lines? We'll start with Cupid, I love you. What followed that?
Cupid, Cupid knows the way.
Cupid knows the way.
He's a naked boy who can make you sway to love's own joy. When he shoots his little arrow, he can thrill you to the marrow. Imagine how he felt.
Oscar Hammerstein II. After a message from Pepsi-Cola, we'll be hearing James Thurber on this farewell broadcast of mine.
The lively crowd today agree. Those who think young say Pepsi, please. They pick the right one, the modern light one. Now it's Pepsi. For those who think young, so go ahead and pick the drink that lets you drink young as you think. Yes, get the right one, the modern light one. Now it's Pepsi. For those who think young.
When James Thurber dropped in for a visit, I reminded the great humorist that he hadn't written for quite some time about a favorite theme of his, the war between men and women. I asked Thurber if he thought the battle of the sexes was slacking off.
Yes, I do. In fact, as one of the commanders of the men's forces, I've largely gone over the side of the women. Because I think that since our sex has darn near destroyed its own species, it's up to the woman to save it. And maybe she will. One line we had in the carnival was, Peggy Cass said, I don't know what happened to it, when a woman surrenders to a man, she has him exactly where she wants him.
James Thurber, is it true, as I've heard, that you wrote for the New Yorker for many, many years before they ever printed one of your drawings?
Yes, I started working on the New Yorker in March 27, and the first drawing that was published in the New Yorker was in January 1931, although Andy White had picked these drawings up off the floor and sent them to the art conference. One was the drawing of a seal on a rock, and Ray Irvin drew a seal's picture right on my drawing and said, this is the way a seal's whiskers go. White sent it back and said, this is the way a Thurber's seal's whiskers go.
What year was it when that famous one we love so much with the man with the foil and the head being cut off and saying, touche?
Oh, that that was a long time ago. And by the way, that was Carl Rose's original idea. I always give him credit and drawing, but it was too bloody. And Ross said, no, I left Thurber. If his man's head is cut off, he can pick it up and put it on again.
James Thurber. Well, you hear complaints about the ferocious amount of material a comedian must use to keep working. You'll never hear the names Smith and Dale. Smith and Dale, a classic act of vaudeville, use the same routines they broke in 50 or 60 years ago. Audiences love them and won't let them change. When Joe Smith and Charlie Dale visited me, I asked them about the beginnings of their greatest routine, Dr. Cronkite, which they perform with the same gusto they must have had when they invented it 55 years ago.
We started in 1906 to do the doctor shop. Now, that is in the part of an encore. And the gag used to be, well, I'm visiting the doctor and I wanted to know how much he charges for a visit. And I was told I was $5 for the first visit, $3 for the second, and $1 for the third. Then when he come out, I said, well, here I am again, doctor. And he said, well, continue on the same medicine. Now, one afternoon, I happened to say, here I am again. He said, what's the trouble with you? Then I said, well, I don't know. Every time I eat a heavy meal, I don't feel so hungry after. Then we started into a routine. Then he said, what kind of dishes do you eat? And I said, dishes? What am I, a crocodile?
Fellas, Joe and Charlie. Use the mic. May I get you fellas to do an excerpt from Dr. Cronkite? The way you open it a little bit.
Well, all right. Now, we said what kind of dish are you in? I said, what am I, a crocodile? Now, continue, if you can remember.
What is your favorite dish?
Dish? What do you mean, the favorite dish?
Yeah.
I mean, aluminum. Aluminum, that's my favorite dish.
You don't get me, you see.
I don't get you. I don't want you.
No, I mean, what kind of meats do you
meats
eat?
Meats will I eat.
Huh?
Will I eat?
I don't ask you, will you? I said, what?
What did I tell you?
What you eat, not will you
I
eat.
Didn't say, will you eat? I said, will I eat?
You said to me,
look, you understand French?
Yeah, yes.
Well, I'm speaking English. I eat wheel. Wee, hee, hey, hell, wheel. What do you think I eat? Wagon wheel? I eat wheel from a cutlet. Wheel cutlet.
You don't say that nice. You should make with a V. Make with a V. Not with a... Well, anyhow, when you eat, how do you like your wheel? Medium?
I like my wheel well to do on one side. The other side optional. You know, when I eat, sometimes...
Well, you see, I look at you. The whole trouble with you is you need eyeglasses.
Eyeglasses? I suppose if I had a headache, I would need an umbrella.
No. I'm going to put you on a diet.
A diet?
A diet of chops, 3 times a day.
Chops?
Yes.
Lamb?
Pork.
What you need is eyeglasses. Well, goodbye, doctor.
Hey, what? You forgot to pay me for my advice.
I ain't going
to
take it.
Smith and Dale. In a somewhat different mood, the poet Carl Sandburg reflects on his Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Abraham Lincoln.
My Lincoln biography is a strange book in several particulars. There's 1.5 million words in the 6 volumes, and they were written by a man whose father could not write his name. And they were written about a man whose mother had to make her mark on deeds, documents, couldn't write. I don't know what it means, but some people say that sounds very American. That could happen only in America.
Carl Sandburg. A few years ago, I cornered 4 movie pioneers. Mary Pickford, Lillian Gish, Harold Lloyd, and Janet Gaynor. And asked them how they felt about the informality of today's movie stars as opposed to the glamorous approach in the old days. You'll hear all of them in this excerpt. First, Mary Pickford.
I think that it's the old-fashioned way was better. I think a person is not as important as their work. And I think that the proscenium arch and the footlight should always be there to separate them from their audience.
Janet Gaynor, do you think it's smarter for us to have to drive around in a block-long white limousine containing 4 matched Russian wolfhounds or go around in blue jeans?
But surely there can be something in between.
Yeah.
And yet I'm not a middle-of-the-roader.
But I believe that the definition for glamour is the illusion of beauty. And I do think that we have many beautiful actresses today, but I don't know that they have the illusion of beauty because they are seen either in their blue jeans or eating their breakfast food. And I'm afraid I'm for the illusion of beauty school.
I think that's very well said, Janet.
Beautifully, certainly is.
Well, Lillian Gish, do you have any thoughts on this subject?
Well, so often people mistake youth for beauty.
Oh, right.
Nearly everyone is attracted young. The two most beautiful women I ever saw in my life were well over 60. One was Lillian Russell, and one was Lena Cavalieri. And Lena Cavalieri looked like a praxiteles. She was something out of marble. You somehow didn't believe anything could be that beautiful, the way the head was on the shoulders, the arms, the feet. And Lillian Russell was not only beautiful, but I think she had swallowed a stove. Every time she came into a room, she warmed it and warmed everyone in it. That may be talent, but both women gave me such an illusion of beauty, I never gotten over it.
Harold Lloyd, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, now, Mitch, of course, I'm in between three lovely girls here. opinion on this. But I think that from a commercial standpoint, that when you do not see the particular subject that you admire and you've seen through the proscenium, you build up your own image, your own idea of what the picture is, and I think it's much better. It can be destroyed so many, many times when you meet the person personally because they destroy your own imaginings.
Mary Pickford, Harold Lloyd, Lillian Gish, and Janet Gaynor. Incidentally, the ladies all looked quite lovely and glamorous, and Mr. Lloyd quite dashingly handsome when we did this broadcast. Now, listen to one of today's big stars on another subject. Richard Burton is not only a big movie name, he is a fine Shakespearean actor. During a broadcast some months ago, I asked someone else at the table about John Gielgud, and Burton interrupted to tell this story about Gielgud and on himself.
I worked with Gielgud a great deal, you know, and in fact, I've modeled, if you can model yourself on somebody, I model myself on Gielgud, certainly in the speaking of verse. And all my early life, in fact, it was he who put on the first play that I ever starred in. He put it on himself with his own money. And it was a success. So he was terribly pleased. But may I tell you one little story? You know, John Gielgud is one of the greatest faux pas makers of all time, I suppose because his mind is so quick and his tongue can't keep up. He drops the most horrendous bricks. He came to see me play Hamlet at the Old Vic, and you can imagine, with the master in front, I really turned on the heat. I went out of my mind that night. And I had the doors open for him, you know, to come around, and we were going to have supper together afterwards, and he's very shy, you know, and he shifts from foot to foot, and his head gets very high and very haughty, and people think he's haughty, he's not, and he didn't quite know what to do, and people were coming to see me, and he was rather embarrassed, so he said, well, dear boy, shall I go ahead, or shall I wait until you're better? I mean, ready.
Alexander King's books and television appearances have made him a household name these past several years. I was the first to give Alex national exposure at these microphones. And when you hear the brilliance with which he held forth in this excerpt, you'll understand why the public seized him from obscurity and made a glamorous celebrity of him as he approached his 60s. I had known Alex King years ago as a wit about town. And I remembered that for years, all his neckties were pink. And I asked him how he happened to wear pink ties. Alexander King.
I was working on the New York World and was getting $25 a week, an enormous sum of money in those days. And I used to take myself out for a walk every Saturday afternoon to take a good look at all the things that I might buy. And so I landed at Salker's on Fifth Avenue, which is a very expensive haberdashery, and they had a sale on neckties. $6 a tie. I wondered what they could have cost before the sale. But then, you know, like vague stray dogs along a deserted street that can't resist their pointless browsing, I was suddenly inside the store. Now, this salesman knew perfectly well that I had no intention of buying anything. Nevertheless, he made fantastic four-in-hand designs in midair, and I was deprecating the stock. I was just getting nauseated with this whole procedure and was going to call the whole ballet off when he seemed to take pity on me, and he said, I have some colors that don't go so well. I'm saving them for my friends. They're a dollar apiece. So I said, well, as long as I'm here anyway, let's see them. So he takes out a box, and in it were 20-some-odd pink ties. I said, not a very large selection. I said, well, they're only a buck apiece. So I bought six. Why six? Because the figure six had obviously gotten stuck in my mind. And I went down to work the first day. I was working on a New York World in the tower. And I showed up with this pink tie, and there was such a yowling and such a screaming that the elevator stopped between floors. And if they only realized I had five more at home. The next day, I came down with a new pink tie, and people began to dance around my table, you know, in that way. Well, they wore down, and in due time, I wore nothing but pink ties. And then next Christmas, of course, everybody gave me 50 million pink ties for a present as a joke. Of course, a great calamity happened to me. I gave them to be dry cleaned, and the store burnt down. And now I was suddenly without pink ties. I couldn't just wear a gray or a green tie because they would say, well, at last you've rejoined the human race, you know. It was a hard-fought battle. I had to stand by my guns. That's the first maxim, you see, of life. So I went and bought myself 3 yards of crepe de chine at Altman's, looked in the yellow pages for somebody who makes ties, rushed up there, and the little nice bearded Jew with a skull cap, you know, looked at this, wasn't at all surprised by the color, and said, it'll be done Friday. Well, Friday was my payday, it was great. I come up there, and he says, $15. I said, $15? I gave you the material. He said, well, but it's a wonderful job, and all that. I said, by the way, how many ties have I got here? He says, you've got 62 ties. And if you'd have bought another quarter of a yard, you'd have had 65.
On that note, reluctantly, I must bring this hour and these broadcasts to a close. After 6 years, summer and winter, I'll miss these weekly gatherings, but I have warm memories of the friends I made here on both ends of this transmission. While I did the series, I refrained from mentioning letters on the air because that's always struck me as a veiled appeal for mail. But now that I'm leaving, I want to take this occasion to thank all of you, those who've written and those who've listened, for your warm encouragement through the years. Knowing you've been there, enjoying us, has been all the lift I've needed to get over the rough spot. On this end, my thanks to Gordon Kotler, who's been associated with me on this show since its first broadcast in June of 1955, and to Stuart Metz, Ken Fickett, Dick Stenta, Bruno Zerato Jr., and Jack Flagler. To my listeners, I hope we meet again soon. Until then, goodbye and good luck.
The Mitch Miller Show has been produced by Bruno Zerato Jr. and directed by Ken Fickett. This is Stuart Metz speaking. Festival concert from Italy on most stations of the CBS radio network.